Dad, you know how you were saying I need to do more, be more, the whole fast fiber thing?
Yes.
Anyways, I saw that Vox is offering free standard installation and activation to the value of 3,000 rand.
That is a good deal.
With the money you save, I can buy some new skins for Fortnite. Talk about money in the bank.
With free activation to the value of 3,000 rand. Live smart. Hack life. Level up with Vox Fiber. Visit vox.co.za. T's and C's apply.
I'm Duncan McLeod, and you're listening to the Tech Central podcast. I'm on a call now with Dominic Cull, an ICT regulatory and legal expert with Ellipsis, who also serves as regulatory advisor to the Internet Service Providers Association. I'm going to be talking to Dominic today about a piece of legislation that could have a serious impact on content creators, ISPs, and just about anyone involved in the internet space in South Africa. I'm talking about the Films and Publications Amendment Bill, which has been winding its way slowly through the various processes and is now sitting on the President's desk, as I understand it, awaiting signature. Dominic, welcome to the podcast, and thanks for agreeing to chat today about this important piece of legislation, which I know has probably given you more than a few grey hairs over the last few years.
Thank you, Duncan. It has indeed. It's been quite a journey. Things have improved, but as you say, I think there's still plenty for us to unpack in this call.
Great. I'm also joined on the call by Rechard van der Berg, my co-collaborator on the Talk Central podcast, who's also very interested in this subject and who I know wants to pose some questions to Dominic. Rechard, welcome. All right, so Dominic, what's the background to the FPB Amendment Bill? How did we get to this point?
Okay, Duncan, I think without belaboring the history too much, if we go back to 1996, we obviously many things changed, and one of the things that changed is that we moved from having a censorship board to having a film and publications board with a very different kind of point of departure from the apartheid censorship authorities. So whereas we were interested in repressing freedom of speech, now with the Film and Publications Act in 1996 and the creation of the Film and Publications Board, it was more about ensuring that South African consumers have sufficient information to make an informed choice about the content which they consume or which their children consume. So hence we all know the little yellow triangle, the Film and Publications Board, which has an age indicator in it and various indicators as to what kind of objectionable or age-sensitive content might be included, so nudity, language, prejudice, things like that. And it then became the role of the board to ensure that where content was going to be distributed to South Africans, it bore that classification mark, and that obviously implied that the board had reviewed it and had come to a classification decision. Fundamentally, and this is incredibly important for the conversation we're going to have, this is an expression of the provision in the Bill of Rights of the South African Constitution that says that everyone has the right to carry on a trade or profession of their choice, but that that trade or profession may be regulated by a law of general application. So what the Film and Publications Act is, in essence, is a piece of legislation of general application which is intended to regulate those who are involved in the business of the distribution of content in the forms of films, publications, and games. So there we go from 1996, and everything's fine because the world is simple and the world is offline, but as we know, that changes with increasing rapidity as we go along. And the board starts to realize that, one, it's not classifying all the content that South Africans are consuming, and two, it's starting to lose a lot of money because the fees which it charges for classifying for offline films, games, and publications are falling as we, as South Africans, consume more and more online content. There's a certainly a degree of validity to the board then saying we need to extend our activities into the online world. And the simple example is it used to be that I would get into my car and drive to the DVD shop, and when I went into that physical store, I would see titles up on the shelves, and there would be little yellow labels on them, and I would make an informed choice as to what I was going to watch. There's no reason why the same logic shouldn't apply to a Showmax or a Netflix. Instead of getting into my car, I'm now just navigating by mouse to a particular portal platform, and there those same titles are. So the board started from a reasonably, I think, understandable and supportable premise that material, which is essentially the same, except it was being accessed through a different medium, should be treated in the same way. Fantastic. Then, however, and now we start to get into the genesis of this Film and Publications Amendment Bill, they decided that there was a whole bunch of content on things like YouTube and user-generated content and Facebook that they weren't actually covering, and how were they going to get around to doing this. And it was at this stage that we started to run into massive controversy, and I think you'll both recall the online content regulation policy, which came out in around 2015-2016. And that was the beginning of the journey in terms of this amendment bill. And we'll talk about the amendment bill now, but just to give you an idea of where we're coming from in terms of that online content regulation policy, just a quote here from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the American privacy group. Only once in a while does an internet censorship law or regulation come along that is so audacious in its scope, so misguided in its premise, and so poorly thought out in its execution that you have to check your calendar to make sure April 1 hasn't come around again. The draft online regulation policy recently issued by the Film and Publications Board of South Africa is such a regulation. It's as if the fabled prude Mrs. Grundy had been brought forward from the 18th century, stumbled across Hustler.com on her first excursion online, and promptly cobbled together a law to shut down the internet. Yes, it is that bad. So that is roughly, and I think a fairly accurate statement of where we were sitting in 2015 and 2016 when that draft policy was out there. That's since been abandoned.
Mm-hmm.
It was finalized, but never actually put into force. And what we got instead was this Film and Publications Amendment Bill.
All right. So there've been changes since the 2015 draft of this legislation. How big have those changes been? Is it a significantly improved piece of legislation?
I'm not going to be the person who defends this legislation. I think it is incredibly badly drafted. I think it's embarrassingly badly drafted. I think it's embarrassing that a document of this nature has gone through a 3 to 4 year parliamentary process and still come out the other side with elementary errors. I think it is quite evident that neither the Department of Communications, which stewarded this bill, or the various portfolio committees or select committees in the National Assembly, which considered it, do not have the required understanding of the online world in order to make this a successful piece of legislation. Having said that, there are significant improvements. So one was that the draft online regulation policy had an incredibly broad ambit in terms of which it would have effectively required everyone who published or streamed any kind of content to register with the board. And despite a lot of the misinformation currently on social media, that is not something that the bill requires at the moment. So the bill makes a very clear distinction between a commercial online distributor and a non-commercial online distributor. And now, bearing in mind the genesis of the Act itself as a law of general application relating to the business of distributing content, it's quite clear that almost all of the obligations in this bill, in the Act, are on those who are in the business. So they apply to Netflix, not to Dominic Cole, who is posting content up onto his personal blog. The non-commercial online distributor is raised in the Act only for the purpose of allowing an avenue for complaints. So if Dominic Cole, in putting that material up on his blog, has written something which Duncan MacLeod believes to be prohibited speech or hate speech, then Duncan MacLeod would be entitled to approach the Film and Publications Board with a complaint. The board would then review that complaint. If it believed that there was merit in the complaint, it would then be entitled to issue a or request a takedown notice in respect of that material. So without going into that in more detail, which we can do later, you know, that is the only way really in which this bill impinges upon the lives of ordinary South Africans. Mm-hmm. There is a grey area between what is an online or a commercial online distributor and what is a non-commercial online distributor. So where does Tech Central's podcast fit in if it's got advertising and Duncan is in fact making money out of Tech Central's podcast? And that is a question that I cannot answer, and I can certainly say to you was never ever considered in the process around drafting of this bill. So we've got two clear poles. We know that Showmax are most definitely in the business of distributing content. They must register. But I am not in the business of distributing content, therefore I would not be required to register. The your son or daughter who is a Fortnite hero and who is streaming their heroics on Twitch or on a YouTube platform, they will not be required to register with the Film and Publications Board. There's been a lot of, like I say, misinformation around that, but I think if we stop and think practically about how that could be achieved, we realize very quickly that that's simply not plausible and possible, and it's not the intention of the Act because we're not in the business of distributing that content.
What happens, for example, if you're a popular YouTuber, and there are very popular YouTubers out there who monetize their channels through Google advertising, for example? Are they expected to register under this legislation?
It's a great question, Duncan. I don't have an answer for you. No, this wasn't contemplated. Are they factually in the business of distributing content? Well, you could argue, yes, they are. Mm. So the blonde-haired gentleman in Neisner who makes a great deal of money out of his YouTube and his YouTube following, you know, is he required to now go and pay 795,000 Rand a year to the Film and Publications Board to register as a commercial online distributor? Is he alternatively just required to register as a normal distributor for a couple of thousand Rand a year, but then submit all his content to the Film and Publications Board for classification before it can actually be distributed on the YouTube platform? I think the better answer is that he would probably not be required to register, but this will need to be clarified with the Department of Communications / the Film and Publications Board. And I'm a little bit wary of where that clarification is going to go, because we've got a real continuum of people who've got no commercial interest to those who've got a pure commercial interest. So if I've got AdSense and I'm earning a couple of Rand a month from my advertising, is that enough to make me a commercial online distributor? It certainly shouldn't. Mm. But the way that this bill has been drafted and the complete lack of attention to this kind of detail in the parliamentary process means we can't actually predict what will happen there at this stage.
It raises another interesting question for news organizations. Let's say I'm ENCA, for example. I distribute a lot of my content online, not just through DSTV, and a lot of that content that I'm distributing is live. So there can't be it's news content, and there can't be pre-approval of it, because that's the nature of news. They can't exactly go call up the FPB and say we're intending to stream this speech given by Julius Malema, and then wait a couple of days or however long it will take for the FPB to approve that. So how would that affect a commercial organisation like a news broadcaster that distributes its content on the internet, that is supposedly under this legislation required to get pre-approval?
So, I mean, Again, Duncan, if we look around, we know that newspapers in an offline world and as a print medium are excluded. Mm-hmm. And one of the useful things this bill does is to ensure that exclusion, to say you guys are actually regulated by the Press Council. Broadcasters, you are regulated by the BCCSA. So we're going to remove you from the ambit of the Film and Publications Board, and you are subject to these other codes of conduct which are aligned with the Film and Publications Act. So there's no, you know, there's essentially an exception for news media, for broadcasters, okay, from that requirement to get pre-publication classification, and a long line of court cases in South Africa which really reaffirms that kind of thinking, that if you're going to have a right which is, you know, freedom of expression, then you certainly can't have any kind of requirement to have pre-publication classification.
I missed part of the conversation as I as lightning struck the house, right? Now, I don't know if you guys have covered this, but so what is limited in the content distribution side of things? I mean, if I produce original content, I won't have to classify it, or anything I put out onto the internet needs to be classified. Is that basically what it comes down to?
No. So that's the – it depends on whether you are to be regarded as commercial distributor or non-commercial distributor. So original content, which is me strumming my guitar, you know, for the benefit of a small group of people, that is not going to have to be classified. Original content, which is being distributed by Netflix, absolutely has to be, or Showmax absolutely has to be classified. And then this gray area between Showmax and me, the continuum of people who to some degree commercialize the content which they're placing on the internet. So from a YouTuber, a PewDiePie who's making literal millions, to someone who's got AdSense and's making R1.32 in the last month, you know, are they both to be referred to as commercial? Is there a threshold which is going to be applied that says, you know, if you earn above a certain amount, then you're required to register? Are we going to do some kind of dominant impression test? Is this your main source of income that you make through distributing content? So Richard, I don't actually have a clear answer, because this was never considered, and it's one of the things that's going to have to be addressed if and when this bill is signed into law.
So is it going to be dealt with through regulation post the enactment of the Act?
I guess that's, you know, I mean, my first bet would, or first prize would be to tear this thing up and throw it away and start again and do it properly. You know, Duncan, there are real challenges to be met here.
Yeah.
There are issues which, in terms of content online, which we actually need to pay attention to. You know, can they fix this through regulation? I actually have my doubts. But they will have to bring some kind of clarity out to say who they regard as having to register. You know, I pause there, because even as I say those words, my heart sinks into my stomach, because I have been fighting with the Film and Publications Board for 10 years about what an ISP is. So if I can maybe just take a small diversion there.
Sure.
An ISP is defined in the Film and Publications Board as any person who carries on the business of providing access to the internet. And under Section 27, Capital A of the Film and Publications Act, as it exists, ISPs are required to register with the Film and Publications Board to facilitate the fight against child pornography. And a note there, instead of saying child pornography, I'm going to say child sexual abuse material, just because it is a better term, and I don't want to use the wrong one that's in the Act. So every ISP in South Africa under the Film and Publications Act and the regulations passed under it is required to register with the board, failing which they are prohibited from carrying on the business of being an ISP in South Africa. The board has essentially taken a definition or an understanding of its own definition to apply this requirement to McDonald's, to coffee shops, to airports, to hotels. In fact, any place where you can get internet access. So they're effectively wanting Woolworths to register with the Form and Publications Board as an ISP. Now, no one on this call, and hopefully not too many other people off this call, are actually going to say, well, logically, that makes sense, that Woolworths is in the business of providing internet access. They're not. They've got a provider behind them. If I'm at the airport, it might be Vast, it might be Always On. I can choose who my provider is. They're the person that would be required to register. So at last count, the Form and Publications Board, when it did one of these exercises of interpreting and giving guidance to the market as to who should register, they had over 800 ISPs registered. Probably 3 to 5 of those were really ISPs. Mm-hmm. The rest are hotels and retail outlets. The biggest ISP in the country, being Vodacom, as far as I know, is not registered. MTN, the same. Cell C, the same. A large number of the large ISPs are not registered. They've all tried before, and there's simply no content to the registration requirements. So you pay your money, you may or may not get a certificate, and then nothing else happens. So eventually they just stop doing it. So this, when we talk about them adopting an interpretation as to what is commercial and what is non-commercial, yes, they may have to do that. The fact that they're going to do it doesn't fill me with confidence or optimism that we'll actually get a clear and sensible result.
Mm-hmm. What are the
I think the danger?
Sorry, Richard, carry on.
No, I was just going to add on to what he's saying. This is the danger, right? Once this thing gets passed and there's no clarity on it, you know, we're not guaranteed of any resolve to this scenario. And I think from what I can see, a lot of the worry comes from the small-time creators on YouTube, the YouTuber-style creator, who's not necessarily making lots of money, maybe making a little bit money, maybe making no money, but none of those guys can survive, right? And these are potentially up-and-coming little businesses in their own right. And that's not even going to talk about, you know, slightly larger companies who actually produce content that's maybe intended as you know, it's not a news broadcast or not a news agency, but it's just you know, commentators, social commentators. All of those people will be stifled.
I couldn't agree with you more. So at the very time that we should be facilitating those kind of developers to come out and shine, and we really need to, this bill has the potential, with this gray area between commercial and non-commercial, to impose obligations on them which are absolutely going to be a disincentive to creating that content, both commercially and administratively. It's a nightmare, and it's scary the kind of consequences that can be visited for a failure. Mm. Having said that, and this is one of the very difficult things about this area of law when it comes to advising people in a hard and fast manner, is there's a terrible history of enforcement. Mm. So if I say to you that an ISP is prohibited by law under regulations from carrying on the business of an ISP unless it's registered with the board, and in the same breath I tell you that the biggest ISP and the vast majority of ISPs are not registered, then you can see that there's just a complete lack of enforcement. There's no ability to enforce or will to enforce, or there's a recognition that they shouldn't be enforcing. And the history of this act is replete with exactly that. So now we get new text and we say, well, it could mean this and it could mean that. But we also very clearly need to factor in the history here, which says that we've been scared about this before, but the fact of the matter is that the board doesn't actually enforce and nothing happens. And what we're left with then is speculative, this may happen in future. So just to bring that point across, that it's very easy to get upset and scared. And having dealt with the Form and Publications Board almost since inception, that's a recurring feeling. But it's never, in fact, been the case that the board has followed through and we've actually, one of those scary scenarios has materialized where everyone is required to register.
Is this legislation really a revenue-raising exercise for the FPB more than anything else?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I think, like I said, I think they needed to look at their mandate and they needed to broaden it to make sure that they could deal with some of the challenges coming with the fact that we consume our content online. The, you know, the tariffs, the 795,000 Rand, I don't think that's a defensible tariff.
Too high.
Certainly wasn't too high. Mm-hmm. And certainly, you know, it might be payable by Netflix, but not going to be payable by local providers. So, in fact, destructive in that sense of local industry. You know, the board receives a budget. It's a portfolio organization of the Department of Communications. So it would receive a parliamentary budget, which I think is independent of the revenue which it raises. And even given the desperation of South Africa's government for revenue at this time, I don't think that's really what's playing out here. There might be some aspect of it, but I don't see it as being primarily that. So, you know, I would say it's primarily one, an attempt to get to grips with online, and then to go in a slightly different direction, it's also a very ill-informed attempt to expand the jurisdiction of the Film and Publications Board. Mm-hmm. So to go back again to why do we have this, general law of application, law of general application for people in the content of people in the business of distributing content. But then suddenly in this bill, we've got things like so-called revenge porn. We've got positions around hate speech. We've still got provisions around child sexual abuse material. And I have fundamental difficulty with the Film and Publications Board being involved with any of that. That is all conduct which is criminal in nature and which sits with SAPS, the National Prosecuting Authority, and the Department of Justice and Correctional Services. It has nothing to do with classification. No one has ever submitted child sexual abuse material to the Film and Publications Board for classification. No one in their right mind would submit so-called revenge pornography to the Film and Publications Board for classification. Simply not going to happen. If it does come into their possession, quite simply, their only role would be to refer that to SAPS for prosecution and investigation. So what we've effectively got is a bit of a land grab from the Department of Communications into territory which is really that of the Department of Justice and the security cluster. And it makes absolutely no sense for this body, the Film and Publications Board, to be making decisions as to what and what is not child sexual abuse material, what is and what isn't revenge pornography, and what is and what isn't hate speech. With regard to the latter, it's particularly problematic in that the Council of the Film and Publications Board is appointed directly by the Minister, whose only obligation prior to appointment is to consult with Cabinet. And in the Act, the range of individuals that she can choose from is extremely broad. So there's a huge amount of ministerial discretion as to who sits on the Film and Publications Board's Council, and these are the people who are then going to be making decisions on complaints about freedom of expression. That's crazy and completely and utterly indefensible. And, you know, point to the history of the Film and Publications Board. When does the average South African hear about them? Well, when we get the spear or when we get Nheba, and there's political pressure on them to go into a gallery, to send five classifiers into a gallery and to look at a presidential penis and slap a 16 nudity rating on it so that children are not allowed in that gallery when that picture's up for display. And it's crazy. So we can see where this potentially ends with that kind of setup. It's again mitigated by the fact that, well, what is the power they've got is to issue a takedown notice. And what do we know about takedown notices is that they're only relevant to content which is hosted in South Africa, which is not Facebook, which is not Google, which is not any of the platforms where the vast majority of objectionable content is posted. So they're essentially being given a power which is not constitutionally defensible. Hate speech is a difficult thing which should only be pronounced on by judicial authorities. And that's being allied with an extremely limited power to actually do something about it. It makes very little sense, to be honest. And it might be that the Film and Publications Board, the Department of Communications, felt like they needed to do something, and that there was pressure for them to do it. I think it would have been more useful, quite frankly, for them to do nothing than to put the provisions that they have into this bill.
Is there a deliberate political attempt through this bill to undermine South Africans' freedom of speech?
It's a tough question, Duncan, and there's a phrase in my head about never ascribe to intention what you could comfortably ascribe to incompetence, which may be of application here. Mm-hmm. So it's never been an overt issue. Even if it had been, then it's still misguided, because we know that Parliament is currently sitting with the Prevention of Hate Crimes and Hate Speech Bill. So if you're going to deal with those issues, deal with them there in the appropriate legislation coming from the appropriate place, not in some cobbled together thing which is actually a law about distribution of content. So, you know, the Hate Crimes Hate Speech Bill, well, that's the one where you would expect that to happen. Might there be potential for abuse in terms of this bill? Absolutely. And it's something that we do need to pay attention to. It was raised in Parliament, but a lot of what was raised in Parliament seems to have fallen on deaf ears. At the same time, because it's related, bear in mind as well that there's a cybercrimes bill which is also slowly making its way through Parliament. I think the National Council of Provinces has recently concluded yet another public participation exercise. So I would anticipate that that's going to be enacted towards the end of the year. And that, I think in that bill, the Department of Justice has seen what's happened. So they've made specific provisions in the Cybercrimes Bill to amend this Film and Publications Bill even before it's been finalized. So they've removed Section 27, capital A. They will have a criminal offense in respect of so-called revenge pornography, which will then delete the one that's in the Film and Publications Amendment Bill. So, you know, the Department of Justice, I think, sees what's going on and where the stuff should be properly situated, and hopefully some kind of sanity will be restored once we get to the Cybercrimes Bill and it removes this criminal conduct from the jurisdiction of the Film and Publications Board.
Is there any argument that the FPB's role should extend to anything beyond the classification of material?
I think there are arguments, and certainly in other jurisdictions, similar boards have similar or have broader powers, particularly around children and exposure to pornography online, age verification, things of that nature. And in South Africa, the South African Law Reform Commission is looking very specifically at those issues and at the role of a regulator like the Film and Publications Board. I think they will be publishing a discussion paper together with draft legislation in the next month or so. Which is going to be fascinating. I think from what I can see, they will probably propose some kind of clean feed legislation for South Africa, as is found in the United Kingdom. So essentially, if as an adult South African you wanted to view pornography, you would need to then opt in order to be able to do so. So there might be an amplified role for the board in terms of ensuring that where content such as pornography, which would be classified 18 and above, is being distributed, they may have a role in ensuring that only people who are entitled to watch it actually do. Again, I'm pausing as I speak because it's another feature of the Film and Publications Amendment Bill we're chatting about, that if you read the kind of memorandum on it, it says it legitimizes the distribution of adult content online in South Africa, which effectively it does. So it says you used to be an adult world, you'd have to get a business premises license. You'd have to get an adult premises license from the FBB. You wouldn't be able to display things. You'd have to make sure people were 18 when they came into your premises. And they've taken those rules and now tried to extend them to an online portal called pornography, where you can actually distribute that pornography in South Africa, but you must take steps to verify ages over 18. And what was amusing in a sense is that you are required to keep a detailed register of all persons who have accessed that pornography and what they've accessed, and you have to make that register available to the Film and Publications Board on notice. So essentially the CEO of the Film and Publications Board would be able to walk in and say, show me your list of who's been watching porn, which I think is pretty much a non-starter as a way to legitimize an adult business going forward, given what is available on the broader, wider internet.
Yeah, people will just
start using. I don't understand the way things work, right? I mean, the internet isn't something you can control. I can understand the argument for classifying films and certain publications. And yes, we know that there's a need for certain steps within online, I guess, to make sure that those major distribution companies actually, you know, have classification on their content. But yeah, for everybody else, it's not going to be enforceable. People will find ways around it.
VPNs.
You know the beautiful thing about VPNs, yeah. You know, the more control you place on some, the more control you place on it, the more eager people are going to be to get around it.
100%. I love the example of India. A couple of years ago, the Department of Telecommunications in India issued a directive to ISPs to block a couple of hundred porn sites, including the really popular ones, Pornhub, things like that. And it was a ban that they rescinded after 2 weeks. And one of the primary reasons for doing so was that an unintended consequence of banning pornography is ensuring that your entire young male population is comfortable with VPNs and encryption. And that's not entirely desired outcome. So look, you know, I have views on prohibition generally. It doesn't work. And you know, to the extent that, I mean, this bill doesn't prohibit except for the kind of content that I think universally, child sexual abuse material, that universally there's an acceptance that you prohibit. I don't think it does any of that. You know, does it stifle? Yes. Does it throw up a raft of unintended consequences, which some people may feel prohibit them from looking at content? Potentially, yes. But I don't think we're at that stage yet where we've got a censor. I think we're just seeing a bit of a shift towards, because of this extension of their powers into hate speech and certain forms of well, revenge pornography and child sexual abuse material, it almost appears as if they're getting that power to prohibit. But in terms of the general content, I don't think that's the position.
I just wanted to circle it back, Dominic, to the ISPs and their requirement to register. I wanted to ask you specifically under this legislation what they'd be liable for. What are they actually required to do in terms of this legislation? And if they don't do it, what happens?
Okay, so, you know, just in terms of what I've already outlined, that requirement to register, you know, the consequence there is ostensibly that you're not allowed to carry on business as an ISP, which is just ignored. There are also fines which apply, you know, potential jail terms which apply. I'm just trying to see in the bill they talk about a failure to register with the board could lead to a maximum fine of 150,000 rand or imprisonment for a period not exceeding 6 months. So for an ISP, it's a fairly harsh consequence. You know, now that I've registered, I've also got an obligation to take reasonable steps to prevent anyone from using my service for the hosting or distribution of child pornography, child sexual abuse material. I think, again, I don't think there's any ISP that would willingly do that, and there are consequences attached, and that's fine. If you want to go and distribute that kind of material, then I don't think anyone has an issue with fairly severe consequences being visited upon you, whether you're an ISP or whoever you are. The bill extends that duty from child sexual abuse material only into hate speech. So in other words, if I have knowledge that my services are being used for that purpose, then I must take certain steps. And so we've talked about the consequences, but you know, let's also look at how does the child sexual abuse material typically get investigated in South Africa involving an ISP? So typically you'd get some kind of Interpol lead coming from a bust in Belgium or Scotland where a computer has been confiscated and they've done the forensics and they've harvested a whole bunch of IP addresses, some of which are clearly South African. They then, the local cyber crimes guys who are generally excellent or commercial branch will then make requests to ISPs for information behind that IP address. Who was the user at a particular time? The ISP has that information either through RICO or through their own commercial records. And as long as the request is made properly, then that information is passed on and the prosecution proceeds and it kind of snowballs as more devices are confiscated and become available to SAPS. What this bill does and what the Act did previously, and they haven't changed it despite us asking multiple times for a change, is that it says where an ISP becomes aware that its network is being used to host or distribute or access child sexual abuse material, they must immediately disable access. So I'm under, as an ISP, under a legislative duty to stop people from accessing it, which is exactly the last thing that SAPS actually want. Mm. They want continued access. So again, we find practically there's just a lack of understanding about what's happening in the world, how these things are investigated, and that, you know, it's incredibly important for SAPS to generate leads based on identified people being involved in child sexual abuse material. has there ever been a consequence for an ISP? Not that I'm aware of. Not for not registering or not taking reasonable steps or not cooperating. Generally, as sad as it is, I probably assist SAPS in relationships with ISPs 3 to 5 times a month with regard to child sexual abuse material. So it's fairly frequent and quite common. But the way it works without any involvement from the Film and Publications Board is actually perfect. So why they're involved here, again, I have no idea. They really shouldn't be. The idea of, given the lack of systems they have, the idea of them being in possession of child sexual abuse material actually really scares me in terms of the nature of that material and its characterization as a continuing abuse of the child. Mm.
Richard, do you want to jump in with anything at this time?
Look, I think we've basically, I mean, I guess we still need to be a bit worried about this bill, but I'm not as worried about it. And please correct me if I should be more worried about it. Although it just shows again, important decisions being made in government by people that don't fully understand the platform that they are trying to govern. And the internet is one of those tricky things. I mean, I hear consultations happen. You know, as somebody that's in tech, you just don't hear about these things before that. Obviously, there's no interest from government to push too much attendance to these things, I'm sure. But I guess we need to be a little bit more vigilant around these things as serious IT users or streamers or broadcasters or enthusiast podcasters for that matter. Because if we're producing content, this would eventually impact us if this goes pear-shaped.
Is it too late for us to have a say? Dominic?
Sorry, dropped out there. Skype died, not sure.
Oh, no problem. I was just adding to Richard's comments there. Is it too late for ordinary people to protest this legislation?
I think it's probably too late. You know, this has been around for a long time. Mm-hmm. And apart from occasionally causing flurries of misinformed discontent on my broadband, there's been very little public notice and outcry. I think there's a continuing opportunity for engagement with the bill, particularly around the issue which is going to be concerning a lot of people, which is whether I am a commercial distributor for the purposes of this bill and whether I'm required to register and have my material classified. And I think it, you know, there's certainly going to be value in people making that real for the Film and Publications Board, the department and government to say this is the kind of effect that that kind of requirement would have on industry in South Africa, particularly smaller industry trying to generate content. You know, I detest the term fourth industrial revolution. It's straight from the marketing department, but it seems to be the currency of government. And if you're going to go about imposing that kind of requirement on small content providers, you are diametrically opposed to facilitating the fourth industrial revolution.
I know you said earlier in our discussion that this legislation, the amendment bill at least, should be scrapped. What should happen next?
The Film and Publications Board should get back into its box and say, this is my function and this is what I do. Let me focus on doing this properly. And I am a creature of statute. I am created by the Film and Publications Act. I have no powers or obligations outside of the words of that act. Let me get back into it and let me classify and inform South Africans and make sure that they can exercise informed consent. Personally, I've got no issue with that at all. Then let justice move in with the Cybercrimes Bill, which they, as opposed to the Department of Communications, Justice has made a very real attempt to understand the environment it's legislating in. That bill has been widely circulated, commented on. There's been an expert group of people with technical background who've commented on it. I have very little difficulties with it, and it's going to sort out some of the things that the FPB shouldn't be involved in. So in other words, justice is going to come along and say, let us take these issues off your hands and deal with them properly so that you can fit back into your box. Then wait for the outcomes of the Law Reform Commission process. Now, however you sit on the issue, we're a deeply conservative country. Our views certainly on pornography and things of that nature are deeply conservative, you know, outside of small patches. I think that's a reality. And I think a lot of people would argue that the ease of access to pornography online is not constructive. It's harmful to children. Again, I'm not going to take a position on that. Where I will take a position, however, is that the majority of the so-called free porn online, you know, is provided as a commercial play to develop your market. So companies like MindGeek, which really are running the hub sites, those are commercial entities, looking to hook people into things in the same way as tobacco and alcohol, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not a freedom of speech issue. That is there to be regulated. I think we need to take a long, hard look at the platforms. I think they're incredibly difficult questions which are raised by the multinationals, the Googles, the Facebooks, the Twitters, who provide us with so much benefit and convenience and we provide them with a great deal of our time, personal information and money. And I don't think, this is a debate taking place around the world. I don't think that there's a fair distribution of responsibility or revenue currently between nation states and those platforms. I think we can see how they all attempt to, you know, without saying they'll comply with specific things, they have their community guidelines, their rules, their policies. You know, there's a large degree of overlap between what Google would regard as unacceptable and what the Film and Publications Board would regard as unacceptable. But there are discrepancies, and those do create issues where we can't actually enforce against the guy who's entering into a racist tirade on Twitter. We can't get that taken down in terms of our own rules. We have to rely on their rules, and I can understand why that would make people uncomfortable. Those are immensely difficult issues that run across freedom of speech, You know, they run very much across taxation issues, and they're running increasingly across competition issues. So I see for the first time our competition commission in South Africa recently raised the prospect of taking a good hard look at the multinational platforms and their effect on competition in South Africa. And I think that's long overdue. Mm-hmm. I think the history of India with regard to Free Basics and Facebook service and the decisions taken there indicate that there's some very important calls that you have to make if you want to develop local industry rather than simply accept, you know, what's coming at you from these large platforms. Mm-hmm. So, sorry, I've extended that question. But, you know, so FPB back in the box, Cybercrimes Bill will fix some of the issues, including deleting Section 27 capital A requiring the registration of ISPs. We registered with the DOJ for multiple reasons already, so there's no need to duplicate that. And then let the Law Reform Commission, you know, conclude its process over the next year or so, looking at regulating some forms of content, whatever the role of the FPB might be there. But that's a bill which will then be debated through the parliamentary process again. And I think, you know, that's, we're going to get sane outcomes. At the moment, we don't have sane outcomes. Mm. sorry, Duncan, I also just want to mention that I used the word embarrassing earlier. And as a lawyer, you often are charged with interpreting the intention of Parliament. So the intention of Parliament is expressed in legislation. And we then go before courts and we argue about what these words actually mean. Mm-hmm. And when something is as badly drafted as this is, and there's such a fundamental lack of the understanding of the environment, it's almost nonsensical to talk of the intention of the legislature because it's not properly formed. And that's evident in a lot of the drafting. So there are three different references to ISPs. They're referred to as ISPs, as I've previously outlined it. Then there's a reference to Internet Access Provider, mm-hmm. not defined, used twice, mm-hmm. introduced in the bill. And then there's a reference to an information system service provider, which is defined in the ECT Act, which means just about everyone. So no consistency there whatsoever. And just to, if you actually had to take the bill to look for an example of this drafting, problematic drafting, you don't have to go far. Section 1B of the bill says, we're deleting the definition of child pornography out of the Film and Publications Act, and we're replacing it with the definition in the Sexual Offences Act, 100%. Section 1C, the very next section, says, we hereby amend our definition of child pornography as follows. So in 1B, you've deleted it. Mm. In 1C, you're amending it. That is simply impossible. Those two things are incompatible. You can't delete it and then amend it. And this has gone through 4 years of Parliament without someone. In fact, people have stood up. I've made submissions and said, you can't, that's nonsensical, please fix it. And it's managed to get through the National Assembly and through all these committees without someone standing up and saying that that's a legal nonsense. And I'm really just giving you one example of many examples in this bill of that kind of sloppy drafting, which is going to make working with this thing practically almost impossible.
Is it not the role of the state law advisors to clean up messy legislation? Now that it's sitting on the president's desk, does it go through the state law advisors, or does he simply have a look at it and sign it or send it back to Parliament?
Look, the state law advisors have looked at this previously,
okay.
And they would certainly have another opportunity to do now. And I've raised this through my contacts in that office, but I'd certainly be hoping that they are taking a good hard look at some of the constitutional aspects of this bill, particularly with regard to freedom of speech. Mm-hmm. I think that's the real vulnerability mm-hmm. in terms of getting this stopped at this stage. If the president's not going to sign, it's because he has a concern that this is in fact not going to pass constitutional muster. And I think just looking at that one isolated kind of power of this non-publicly accessible council to make decisions on freedom of speech, to me, that's fairly obvious that that's not constitutional. They should never be in that position, and we should never be in that position of being limited by people of that nature.
So do you think it's likely then, if this is signed into law, that this is going to be challenged in the Constitutional Court?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I do.
So kind of just a waste of time and money at this point.
There's some useful stuff. Okay, and I mean, you know, so if Netflix is going to register, how do they go about classifying that material? So, you know, they've introduced notions of self-classification. So Netflix can send someone to the board to get training in how to classify under South African legislation, and then they can do that, ostensibly. Showmax can do that. That's what you pay the 795,000 rand a year to do. I'm not answering your question. I'm going somewhere else, but it's fascinating that this requirement to register as an online distributor has actually been around for about 3 years now. Even notwithstanding that this bill has not been passed yet, it's something that they've tried to introduce. And if anything gives you an indication of the massive mess the law is in here, is if you look at who has registered and who hasn't. So on the side of those who have, you find Google, Apple, Showmax. On the side of those who haven't, you would find Microsoft and Netflix. And where I see a division between companies of that stature as to how they should approach this, it screams problem to me. Because you know, Netflix and Microsoft are companies which have to care about their reputation and doing business in different jurisdictions. And Netflix have quite simply said, we don't believe we have to. We're not going to.
Interesting. Dominic, this has been a great discussion, but I think we'll wrap it there. We're an hour in. Lots to digest, lots to think about, and it's going to be very interesting to see what the president does with this piece of legislation that's sitting on his desk. Recha, thanks so much for joining us on this call today. Dominic Kull is ICT regulatory and legal expert with Ellipsis, and he also serves as regulatory advisor to the Internet Service Providers Association. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Great pleasure. Thank you, gentlemen.